Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up, the stories everyone's talking about in retail today, including Walmart and Rite Aid. We'll also discuss what people aren't talking about when it comes to Sprouts Farmers Market and their earnings call. And finally, we'll dust this one off with Advance Auto Parts and talking about their earnings that came out this week. Our interview guests, Michael Zolot and Jeff Sandler of Brother, will discuss printing technology in today's retail landscape and how it's changed over the last several years. But first, as we talked about, Walmart. They released earnings this week. Anytime Walmart releases earnings, it's big news in the world of retail. Their earnings this week were released on Tuesday, and the results indicated mixed execution and a slowing of e-commerce growth over the more robust comps from the prior year's quarter. We kind of expected that slowing of e-commerce growth, and it really wasn't quite as bad as some analysts had portrayed it. There were, in fact, some positives on this earnings call, beginning on same-store sales.
If you're a shareholder, you were probably paying attention to this earnings call because here lately, over the last couple of quarters, and we'll note this throughout this podcast, but they've been doing really well in terms of e-commerce execution. That's led to overall double-digit growth. A lot of analysts have been really looking towards double-digit. We're talking 30, 40, 50, even as high as 60% growth in e-commerce. And this is really the story here because Walmart, as Trent mentioned, is the nation's largest retailer, but overall, you're seeing that they're actually a growing competitor to the likes of Amazon. Walmart ended up beating on same-store sales and overall revenue, which is good for the company. And it's a good sign for them considering store growth is slowing, as is international unit expansion. I remember about 9-10 years ago, that was the main story for Walmart, is their international presence and how they've actually stagnated here in the United States. And then they're looking towards countries in Africa, they're looking towards East Asia as a way of expanding their store presence. But now you're seeing that actually a lot of that growth is here domestically now because of that online entrance. Revenue for the fourth quarter hit $136.4 billion ahead of Wall Street predictions by about $1.5 billion, over a 4% jump in sales. I believe it was a 4.1% year over year. Same store sales came in better than inflation at 2.6%, whereas analysts were eyeing a magic number of around 2.2% in the United States. And speaking of those domestic stores, traffic was up about 1.6%, and the average ticket grew about 1%. Here we will remember that wages are increasing, albeit ever so slightly above current inflation levels, but nevertheless, this leads to more spending from the consumer. Since we know that savings rates are actually at all-time lows, they're actually spending that money somewhere. Either it's new car sales or it's going into your local Walmart to shop. We would have liked to see average ticket growth a little bit more, around 1.5 to 2.2% because of that, but it is good to see that more customers are coming to the Walmart stores. Good to see better traffic. Again, overall, it's a good sign for the retailer as you tend to think of Walmart as a company a lot of people shy away from. Everybody talks about preferring to shop at Target, but at the end of the day, they are more concerned about the price of the goods that they buy on a weekly basis. Sam's Club saw same-store sales increases of 2.4%, which we think is a good number. We are curious to see if this number is going to be changing in the coming quarters because they have over 60 less Sam's Clubs in the United States due to some recent closures and in Puerto Rico. One would think that this number is actually going to be a little bit better because the stores they closed were supposedly ones that were a bit more underperforming in their relative markets. Trent, as we move on, we see that there were a lot of negatives. A lot of these negatives actually were most likely to blame as far as the stock price having dipped around 10% on this earnings call on Tuesday.
And there are a number of factors that build into these negatives, but probably the first negative outside of people seeing e-commerce sales were margins. And margins dramatically cut this quarter. Honestly, a number of things to blame here. marketing one of them. Those holiday shopping commercials that they aired a lot of were not free. They bought into the Olympics as well. If you've watched any of the Winter Olympics, a massive advertising buy there for Walmart. And the company has spent a lot of money on social media routes as well. So marketing building in to cut margins a little bit. As a result of the margins decreasing, earnings per share missed the mark for them at $1.33 or $1.33 per share versus analyst expectations of $1.37 per share. This is on an adjusted basis. Without adjustments, you're looking at 73 cents per share. Now, to put these numbers into context, Walmart fared far better for the shareholders last year, bringing in $1.22 on a non-adjusted basis. So nearly 50 cents per share more on a non-adjusted basis. Now, granted, Walmart has made a lot of expenditures, particularly with purchases of other companies. Also, as we've talked about already, the ad expenditures this year have cut into margins dramatically, but brought in more top line revenue. Net income, though, of $2.1 billion, that was roughly $1.6 billion off from last year. So they're bringing in more money. They're just not as profitable on the amount of money that they're bringing in. We call that in retail the Amazon model. Doug McMillon, the CEO, said that strength was broad-based across merchandising categories, formats, and regions. That's a positive in that they don't have one department in particular that's struggling. We talk about Target as another general merchandise retailer. We know that they're struggling in food and perishables on again, off again over the last couple of years. Formats and regions also strong across the board for Walmart. So neighborhood markets doing as well, if not better, than the traditional Walmart stores. And their holiday sales were solid as expected. In addition, comp store inventory, and this is crucial for the company, declined again for the 11th consecutive quarter. Now, there are two arguments to be made here regarding Walmart's inventory. One is, of course, it's good to have solid inventory control because that'll help you out on margins long term. But the second argument to be made is that perhaps Walmart is having trouble with inventory management. Layton talked about 10, 11 years ago, people were talking if Walmart had run its course and kind of saturated the United States. Well, something that they were talking about 5 to 6 years ago was whether Walmart was properly stocking their stores. And this might come into question again as you start to see some customer feedback regarding certain retailers being able to keep items in stock. But overall, Walmart seems to be scoring out pretty well on this topic, and we haven't seen a decline in traffic as a result of the decline in inventory levels as we have in the past with the company. Now, online sales was and is a focal point for the company. It will forever be a focal point of analysts, and we'll talk about that when it comes to Sprouts a little bit later on. But Walmart has grown Walmart.com sales substantially in the last two quarters, much of the reason why the company's stock was recently at all-time highs. You had a lot of optimism built in there regarding their e-commerce initiatives. However, this quarter, which went against tougher comps 1 year ago, saw just a 23% rise in online sales. Now, this is not behind most retailers. In fact, many retailers are seeing about 13 to 17% of an increase in online sales year over year, at least the more robust ones are. Now, Walmart saw a 60% rise in quarter two and a 50% rise in the third quarter. But again, as I talked about, they're up against a strong fourth quarter from last year. And remember that last year's fourth quarter was the first one that saw the inclusion of Jet.com. So these are more true comps on comps. And I think that 23% growth is more authentic growth rather than the growth that was perceived as being there from just purchasing different e-commerce outlets. But despite this slower online growth, the company's leadership remains adamant that they'll achieve 40% e-commerce growth in fiscal 2019, or for those of us that use the calendar years, it'll be calendar year 2018. This is going to be a tall order, especially with just 23% in this fourth quarter. But they do have more channels to exploit in order to reach this lofty goal, including a number of new store installations for customers to pick up their orders. This goal would essentially meet the growth number in terms of top-line revenue of Amazon over the last few years. Now, acquisitions could also help. They've already acquired a number of online retailers. They did that in 2016, 2017. No reason to believe that it'll stop in 2018, as they've probably got some purchases on their radar. they've made an attempt to differentiate themselves in apparel a little bit more. And if you want to point an acquisition, the Bonobos acquisition, certainly one of those that you can point to regarding the apparel universe. But it's very difficult, at least in a brick and mortar sense, for them to be seen as a trend-setting retailer. And unless they keep that brand separate, as they have with Bonobos, it's going to be difficult for Walmart to set themselves apart. Not too many people, you would imagine, in the fashion realm are going to go to Walmart.com to search out clothing, but they might go to a different brand that they know and trust. One of the reasons why it might benefit Walmart to purchase those e-commerce stores. And Leighton, I know you were on the earnings call and you felt like executives were overall fairly bullish about the future of the company.
Yeah, some exciting words, especially from CEO Doug McMillon, who, by the way, was once the president of Sam's Club. But you heard words like speed and creativity that were used to define their strategic approach going forward for the rest of calendar year 2018, the latter of which were uncommon to Walmart not too long ago. You hear words like creativity. This was something that Walmart was sort of against. They were actually leaving a lot of e-commerce spending up to a lot of other retailers, and now they're catching up in a significant way. So I am curious to see if they are able to hit their 40% marks for their e-commerce growth through the rest of 2018 and beyond. Shares of Walmart are still up significantly over the last 12 months or so, but down around, again, 10% from recent all-time highs, around $110 a share, in fact, here recently, currently trading around $93 a share. But again, near all-time highs not too long ago. A lot of analysts, a lot of shareholders really bullish on the prospects for Walmart and Walmart.com. We move on to our second story with Rite Aid, which they've potentially found a suitor for its stores that have not been sold off to Walgreens. A lot has been talked about Rite Aid, especially with the Walgreens deal and the trials and tribulations from that deal over the last 18 months or so. While pharmacy retailers are in a good spot in terms of overall future growth opportunity, Rite Aid has admittedly not kept up too well with their competition, namely Walgreens and CVS. They are still the third biggest standalone operator in the United States with around 2,500 locations left over after the Walgreens deal. That very deal ended up being around 1,932 locations they had to divest. That was back in September. That deal was worth just north of $4.3 billion. Of course, this number was originally going to be much higher, both the purchase price and the number of stores going to be divested, but regulators put a stop to that after several attempts to move forward by Walgreens. We noted at the time a slew of things that Rite Aid could do with the money. Again, we had a podcast in September talking about this very issue, but we talked about them possibly paying down debt and changing or rehabbing some of their older locations. This deal gives shareholders of Rite Aid two different options instead. Now that we have Albertsons aboard, talking about buying the 2,500 locations left over after the Walgreens deal, we see that shareholders are actually a bit in flux here because this deal is going to be offering them for every 10 shares, they're going to be able to sell the shares for $1.83 and receive just one share of Albertsons stock, or receive straight shares of Albertsons, 1.079 shares to be exact. So you have two different options here. And this is interesting because when all the media headlines came out this week talking about Albertsons taking over the remaining Rite Aid locations, we did not see a bulk number. Usually with a buyout or an altogether acquisition, you see a number such as $20 billion for all the remaining Rite Aid locations. This is going to be structured a little bit differently, partly because Albertsons is a privately held entity. Something that is missing is this total buyout price, but luckily, thanks to a lot of analysts out there on the internet, we can dig a little bit deeper and go further into what this exactly means for shareholders. Investor Place has done somewhat of basic math here. It amounts to basically $2.50 per share. Right now, to put that into context, shares of Rite Aid are trending around the low $2 range, which is better than the price point that Rite Aid was trading at before the announcement and over the last 3 to 4 months. So roughly speaking, this is a 25% premium, but not much more than they were trading on prior to October of 2017. So obviously, that all being said, a 25% premium doesn't look that bad. But if we remember, we tend to have short-term memories in terms of stock prices. Shares were actually above that not too long ago. So obviously, that said, a lot of shareholders are actually a little pessimistic on the deal, but they will have voting rights to vote in or out this acquisition by Albertsons. margins for Rite Aid actually have been creeping up steadily over the last 6 months too. And because of them being able to pay down debt, that's going to help their balance sheet. That's going to help their income statement. So I think a lot of longtime shareholders were actually hopeful for 2018 and to maybe see those shares go north of $3. So a lot of different things happening here with this deal, but for now, it seems as though the two companies will merge and there will be little consolidation with the outstanding units, therefore meaning that we will probably not see a lot of Rite Aid locations closed. Albertsons, of course, has multiple banners in 35 states, 20 banners in all, and about 73% of their grocery stores already have pharmacy counters. Combined, if this were to happen, if everyone were to vote in favor of this deal coming together, they would be operating 4,350 pharmacies in the United States in total, 320 clinics in around 38 states, Trent.
And full disclosure here, I am a Rite Aid shareholder for quite some time, and I'll be honest, I'm one of those that's confused about the deal, and it would not surprise me if shareholders were to shoot back somehow at Rite Aid for getting this deal done, because as you mentioned, Leighton, this deal amounts to basically $2.50 per share, and a lot of Rite Aid stockholders, myself included, felt like the share could actually make it over $3 in the next calendar year, because you remember part of the reason their share price has been deflated is because of all the legal costs associated with that Walgreens deal. Now you might begin to see more positive earnings calls going forward. But still, let's go through some of the takeaways of this deal, which is very complex. The current CEO of Rite Aid, John Standley, will be in the head leadership position for both companies, both Rite Aid and Albertsons, if the deal goes through. Usually you don't see this with this type of a purchase, but again, Albertsons apparently impressed with his current vision, and the current Albertsons CEO, Robert Miller, you know, he's been getting up there in years. We followed his career for quite some time. He'll stay on as chairman of the board, so he's still going to remain with the overall company. Miller began his career working at Albertsons nearly 50 years ago, and he was at Fred Meyer in the 1990s. Fred Meyer, of course, a robust Pacific Northwest chain. We talked about the lack of consolidation here. Well, that tied into their proposal to keep both headquarters as well, which might be a relief to some salaried corporate employees. Surely there's going to be longer-term pressure to combine and make efficient certain departments. As Leighton often talks about, synergy really just means cost-cutting in terms of staff in many cases. They will, however, be looking to streamline the branding aspect. All current Albertsons pharmacies, akin to what Target and CVS have going on, they will use the Rite Aid name and signage. Now, I believe this is a good move to endorse a consistent message if this deal goes through, and I think Leighton feels the same way. So it's not only Albertsons pharmacies, but other pharmacies within their set of chains as well. You'll recall a prior interview on the Retail Focus about a half year ago with the former social media manager of United Supermarkets. They'd be included there, as well as retailers like Randall's, Tom Thumb, and so on and so forth, including Safeway as well. So this all will make Rite Aid the largest or second largest pharmacy operator by square footage in 70% of the U.S. metropolitan areas. It's crazy to think about this, but we were talking just a few months ago about Rite Aid maybe ceasing to exist as a brand, and now they're going to be one of the largest pharmacy retailers in the country because of these rebranding efforts. Statements by executives state the obligatory mission of being able to serve their customers' health, wellness, and food needs. We didn't really get anything too interesting by executive statements, and again, part of that is because Albertsons is currently a private company. Now, other takes on this, and again, I mentioned full disclosure, I am a Rite Aid shareholder, and while Rite Aid has issues diminishing the possible merger here by saying Albertsons is simply buying the remnants is doing the deal a disservice, there's still a significant portion of Rite Aid left behind, and not only Rite Aid, but the Rite Aid brand, which Albertsons apparently finds valuable considering their note that they would be rebranding. Albertsons would actually be getting more Rite Aid stores than Walgreens did and would now have significantly more buying power and marketing prowess to drive traffic to experience potentially lower prices on not only drugs, but also front-end items. We forget here that the synergies on top of cost control through staffing, if there were to be any, extend far beyond that. And Albertsons can do some potentially very interesting things with the Rite Aid stores they've acquired. And likewise, the branding change might be able to build out the Albertsons pharmacies because, again, people respond to that Rite Aid logo, they see that Rite Aid messaging, and they recognize that as a pharmacy where they may not be able to do so with some of Albertsons' many, many private brands that they have. And it's nice, just from a nostalgia standpoint, that the Rite Aid banner will live, but again, as a shareholder, it's a little bit of a shame that they don't get a chance to kind of prove themselves out as a smaller iteration of Rite Aid and get a chance to boost those margins in today's retail pharmaceutical landscape. Shareholders, myself included, still have to approve the merger, but then we'll have to decide later on whether or not to hold onto Albertsons stock in anticipation of an IPO later this year as a result of the deal. Of course, us, as far as media members go, we're excited regarding the IPO because we don't get too much of a glance into Albertsons' financials, and we'll get a lot more of it going forward if they do go public. It's time now in the show to talk a little bit about the Internet Retailer Conference and Exhibition coming up. It's hard to believe, just around the corner, June 5th through the 8th at McCormick Place West in Chicago. IRCE is your one-stop shop for all of your e-retail needs. This conference and trade show offers you everything your business needs to stay ahead of your competition in one simple location. Spend some time with us to learn, discover, and network all in the world-class city of Chicago.
IRCE offers two full conference days with various tracks with pre- and post-conference workshops discussing all the new industry trends. Their exhibit hall at IRCE features over 600 top solution and technology vendors ready to help your business succeed in every facet. The hall covers over 250,000 square feet of space. And for reference on this podcast, Trent, that's over 20 Rite Aids worth, making it the largest e-commerce trade show in the industry, ensuring you'll find the solutions you need.
Some of the main stage speakers announced: Seth Godin, the author of What to Do When It's Your Turn. And of course, we've all heard about House. Well, Alan Cohen of House is another main stage speaker announced for this year. Also, 10,000 attendees will be there, 600 plus solution providers, and over 130 conference sessions with over 200 speakers. Go to IRCE.com and click Register to Attend under the Attendees tab and enter promo code RETAIL18. For 10% off conference passes. It's IRCE.com. Enter promo code RETAIL18 for 10% off those conference passes. Well, as we continue our NRF 2018 interview series called Deconstructing Retail, we're looking today at an area of retail that not a lot of people talk about externally that aren't retailers, in printers. And who else and who better to talk about printers than the folks at Brother? After all, Brother is synonymous with printing technology and has been for the last two decades. We're joined by Michael Zolot, the Director of Sales for Vertical Markets in the Commercial Machine Division of Brother, and also Jeff Sandler, who is in marketing at Brother. Please to talk with you both here today. And first, for those that maybe don't work in retail, or even that work in retail but work in different parts of retail, what different areas of a retail store do printers touch?
The nice thing with printers is they're an essential part of every retailer. And most of the time, the printers are in either the cash wrap or the back office. And they can touch a lot of the different software and programs associated, whether they're printing out signage, whether they're printing out labels, where they're printing out planograms. So there's so many applications that our products touch throughout the retail store. But the nice thing is, not only in the store, but we also work with all the retailers on the corporate side, in the warehouses, because our products fit really everywhere within the retail environment.
So Mike mentioned some really great applications. You know, there's a whole bunch in addition to that. And the fact is that, you know, today's retailers looking for devices that are very robust, reliable, and that can meet their needs in a variety of different applications. And you know, I think we've done a really nice job of working with those retail partners to deliver those kinds of solutions for the types of things that they need every day, day in and day out, to run their business.
So one of the things that I mentioned with Mike before the interview that I wanted to touch on, I remember when I first started working in retail a couple of decades ago, everyone was talking, oh, we're going to go paperless. Eventually, all of this stuff will be on the computer. But you mentioned a good point, planograms. I have yet to see a business go completely to digital planograms. Why is paper such an integral part of the retail experience from a retail store owner's perspective?
We've been hearing paperless for a long time too, and I would definitely say print volumes have gone down because there's applications that do go away with the use of technology, which they should. But most people still need that paper to hand to somebody, to see, because a lot of times on the tablets, depending on what you have, you can't get the full visibility. So when you are doing a planogram, as you mentioned, it's hard to see small pictures and environments. So you really want either an 11 by 17 planogram that you can fully see everything, or you really want to have an inventory list spread out so you don't have to scroll up and down and you can have multitask at the same time.
So it's interesting because we're talking about output, and Mike's exactly right. And the fact is the paperless office has been around as a concept for a long time, but it's not going away anytime soon. But by the same token, there's still a lot of applications in retail environments where capture, i.e. scanning, and the transmission of data electronically, securely, is a necessary animal out in the world of retail today. Think about bringing on a new employee and having to take the social security card and other identification information and then transmitting that securely, or sales data or point of sale receipts that you want to send up to your headquarters so they can see what your daily results are. These are all the types of things that can be captured electronically using scanners, which in our case is also part of what we do at Brother as well, and is one of the ways that we're helping these retailers be effective and also transmit their information the way that they need it to be done.
You mentioned not only scanning information, digitizing it, but also security, and that's something I want to touch on very quickly here. Over the last couple of decades, there have been a lot of changes in your guys' space, just as there have been in the retail space. It's really no different there, but one of them is the increased emphasis on security, and that's something that you guys touch on not only with your retail product solutions, but also on your website. You guys are very bullish about providing security options. What has changed in the last 10 to 20 years as far as your guys' approach to not only security, but some of the other aspects of your business?
Honestly, it's a great question, and I'm really glad that you visited our website and saw some of the areas that we're touching on. And the reality is that there's external threats going on. You know, it doesn't have to be just Brother calling attention to it. I think there's an awareness over the last, as you referenced, probably 5 to 10 years, where folks have become very, very sensitive to it, particularly as there have been, if you will, break-ins by hackers that have created havoc for a lot of different folks and the issues that that's raised for them. What we're focused on is making sure that our devices are secure on the network and that we deliver the types of answers that our retail partners are looking for so that they know that they can meet their compliance needs, they can meet their security needs, and protect the confidential data that they have. So regulatory and security compliance issues are very hot topics. I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon.
Yeah, and the only thing I would add is we have a field of engineers that we work with that help customize solutions for every retailer. No retailer really is alike. So everyone has a customized solution. And so what we do is we make sure to work with everybody so they're PCI compliant and make sure that our printers are a part of that solution for them.
Once again, we're talking with Mike Zolot, Director of Sales at Brother, and Jeff Sandler, who's with Marketing at Brother here on the Retail Focus Podcast on the floor at NRF 2018. We've talked a little bit about advancements, and one of the things that you guys have been very clear in mentioning also on the website, but here in your exhibit as well, the compact nature of the printer. And anyone who's worked in retail knows that A, retail offices are an absolute mess 90% of the time, and B, one of the things that gets mentioned pretty frequently is that retailers are trying to maximize their sellable square footage. So the offices, if they weren't a mess to begin with, they're becoming smaller. So how have you guys tried to fit that smaller office, that smaller back room area with more compact solutions for printing?
So stores are shrinking. We all know that. And as you said, the back offices are tight. But where we're seeing a big trend is people really putting the printers in the cash wrap. So in the front of the house. And so when you're creating these cash wraps, they are a very tight space. They're putting a lot of different products and information into the cash wrap. And so space is the first and foremost priority for them, is how is it gonna fit? What is it gonna look like? And as the trend is going more from printers to multifunction, you know, we really need that space. So Brother just launched a new series of printers that really is the perfect fit for the cash wrap and something that we're really promoting at the show.
Yeah, so just following on to what Mike said, so it's not only the device itself, it fits in the space, it's got the productivity and reliability, the features that they need, it's got the security, it's got the connectivity, all of these things are done in a very tight space, and that's really something that we're very well known for. In addition to that though, into the other areas of the store, or even in the other areas of their operation, We have a range of products that can meet a variety of different needs, all meeting their security requirements and also the reliability and other qualities that they expect, including very low operating costs.
One of the areas of retail printing we haven't talked about too much yet is shelf edge labels. And obviously that's huge in retail. Any given retail store, especially a grocer you go to, is going to have thousands, if not tens of thousands of those. How has technology advanced in the shelf edge label area?
Doing that in lots of different ways. One of the big trends is obviously on the mobile printing side. So we have a full lineup of mobile printers that you can print shelf edge labels as needed versus sheet labels. So we do it both ways, and that's the nice thing about Brother. We have the product lineup to really do it any way the retailer wants. And so I wouldn't say the tags have changed much, but what you're printing from and what type of printer you're printing from is what's changing.
So we've talked a little bit already about advancements, not only in terms of size, but also in terms of security. But what's next for printing in retail? What do you guys think is the next frontier? Obviously, without giving away company secrets or anything like that, what can retailers expect to see in the printing space or even in the print-to-digital conversion space over the next few years?
So it's really about solutions and really getting rid of the bottlenecks of productivity. And so everything we do is really creating better processes. And the printer, as we all know, is part of each application, is part of a process. And so what we try to do is work with different companies and to create full solutions. We work with the retailers to customize buttons. And then from a product standpoint, we really want to make sure that all of our features are advanced. So whether it's cloud, whether it's scanning, whether it's mobile, you know, we're working with all the devices to make sure we create the best solutions for our customers to make it as simple as possible. Because in retail, it's all about simple and easy.
So following on what Mike said, you know, I don't think you're going to find some great new innovation per se that's going to change the face of printing in retail. But to Mike's point, it really is about solutions. And unfortunately, that's a very frequently used word, sometimes overused. But the reality is that it's working with retailers to come up with the things that they need in order to get the job done. So we obviously sell boxes of devices, but in talking to those customers and understanding, well, gee, maybe they need something that's a silent installer so that it doesn't create calls back to their help center. Gee, maybe we need to set up an auto routine so that something's scanned to a secure folder so that somebody can pull it down later. Maybe they need a particular device to handle a certain level of print volume or scan volume or a combination thereof. And maybe what they thought was the right solution may not be the right one because they need a more robust device to meet their needs. It's more about those conversations and partnering with those customers to understand those applications. That, to me, is a big difference where we've been much more at the forefront than maybe we were 5 or 10 years ago. And I think that's what's helping differentiate what it is that we're doing out in the marketplace today.
It's interesting from talking to you guys, it seems much more about customizability than I think a lot of people would figure. It seems like, just if I were to mention printers and retail, someone might say there's a lot of one-size-fits-all solutions out there, but what you guys are touching on, it seems a lot more like you guys are working on a one-on-one basis with these retailers to come up with retailer-specific solutions.
It's really true. I mean, I think it's funny because, of course, we'd love to say, well, we've got the next greatest new thing, but in today's market, it's really about speed. It's about what is that customer looking for to differentiate themselves, because they're looking for ways to be more productive. They're looking to help cut their costs. We're all about helping to make that happen. And I think that requires a conversation. So by having that conversation, understanding what challenges they're facing, then we can come back to them. And I think folks have been very impressed, a number of our retail partners, with the types of things that we can do. Mike and his team have done a great job, along with the rest of the staff. And it goes all the way back to our folks back in Japan. We really are very tightly integrated to try to deliver those things that do make us unique. So, you know, it's not just the hardware, it's the connectivity, the solution, and the security that retailers need so that they can propel their business forward, and we can help them in that regard.
The only thing I would add is our tagline is at your side. And so besides customizations, it's really about support for us. And we try to go above and beyond for our customers on the support side. So whether it's next day swap warranty, whether it's training help desk calls, you know, it's all about reliability. I always say the most important thing about a printer is it prints. And so that's what we try to accomplish for our customers, to make a reliable, secure solution.
All right, Mike Zolon, Jeff Sandler, thanks so much for joining us on the Retail Focus podcast today.
Appreciate it. Thanks for the time.
Thanks, Trent. It was great.
Well, with everyone talking about Whole Foods and Amazon coming together, Sprouts Farmers Market showed robust earnings in the fourth quarter with a slight beat on analyst expectations. Many analysts have been critical of Sprouts' future prospects, as said analysts have bought into the Amazon Whole Foods synergy potential there. We see a lot of cost cutting at Whole Foods markets. But going forward, it will be a little bit hard to see exactly how the numbers are faring because of Amazon's reports. We see in this latest quarter, we got the revenue from Whole Foods, but we don't have all of the margins or all the little details that we had when Whole Foods was a separate entity. However, this latest quarter suggests that the 285-store Sprouts may be a little bit more efficient of the two brands when compared side by side, at least for now. Earnings numbers, well, Trent, they're kind of good. Net sales rose to $1.1 billion, which was representative of a 16% increase from their 2016 fourth quarter. This is also representative of a 12.6% bump in overall store count. They have been growing their units throughout the U.S. in the fourth quarter of 2016 versus that. We have 32 more stores, 32 new stores this year, and some robust comps because you see that addition of 16% sales, well, that's a factor of two things. Same-store sales grew to the tune of 4.6% on top of last year's slimmer growth of around 0.7%. With top-line revenue increases of this nature, one would expect that the bottom line also grew since they've been profitable, and it indeed did, up to $40 million for this quarter. Diluted earnings per share of around 29 cents per share. This is representative of a 142% increase from last year's fourth quarter. However, the company was quick to note that a significant amount of this bottom line boost was as a result of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act here passed recently. Adjusted earnings after the non-cash benefit were 16 cents per share, and this is very rare, a very rare circumstance indeed, because the company reporting adjusted earnings lower than GAAP earnings, not something we see often here, at least in the retail sector. The 16 cent mark was a penny beat versus analysts' expectations from Zacks, and you see that this being their fourth quarter, they also released their year-long numbers. 2.9% comp increases, outpacing most grocery retailers who came in around 2% or lower even in some cases. Net sales of $4.7 billion, up 15% from 2016. And again, for the full year, diluted earnings per share of $1.15, adjusted earnings per share of $1.01, up 22% from 2016. And cash flow, something that a lot of analysts have actually been looking towards for this company as an acquisition target, seems to be in the positive, Trent. Cash flow for the year was vastly positive, up 22% to $310 million, something promising to see. However, and perhaps the lone slightly negative point we picked up on was their high rate of borrowing on their credit facility. 348 of their $450 million line of revolving credit is taken up currently, 1.4 times net to EBITDA ratio as well. This, of course, means higher interest payments going forward. This is something that we've talked about with Rite Aid here recently, taking up a massive amount on their balance sheet. As we'll see, the company expects to reduce their CapEx in 2018. It was actually higher than expected in 2017, which may mean the ability to pay this down further. Granted, some of this will be pitched to help share buybacks, over $300 million worth, that their board just approved. But Trent, why the overall improvement, and why are you in particular so bullish on Sprouts?
Yeah, Sprouts is a company that I, as you mentioned, am bullish about. And part of that is because I love Amin Maredia, their CEO. I feel like he's got the company pointed in the correct direction. And he's one of those guys, when you listen to earnings calls, when you watch interviews, you feel like he's got it all together. He goes above and beyond some of the corporate speak and above and beyond some of the typical platitudes that you get from a CEO to give you true insight on his company. And of course, we enjoy any CEO like that. Basically, one of the constant themes of their earnings call that I was on was team member development or ongoing employee training. Now, a lot of businesses give lip service to employee training, but as we discussed with Home Depot in last week's podcast and their company that also had outstanding earnings this week, some retailers take it more seriously than others, and Sprouts insists that expanding training programs is necessary right now due in part to some of their increased technological initiatives, some of those on the back end we'll discuss later. It's refreshing to hear this. Other retailers, and I look at Macy's in the department store segment, they've jumped into omnichannel with both feet, but without seemingly training staff on the technology. If you go through and look at some of the more recent complaints about Macy's, it's almost entirely because of employees not understanding their omnichannel capabilities. The other reason that I think Sprouts training programs for employees is of note is because of the prevailing analyst thoughts surrounding Whole Foods Market, is that employee benefits, pay, and training may begin to be trimmed under Amazon, and that would keep with trends in other portions of Amazon's fulfillment efforts throughout their company. Now, Meredia mentioned that their internal metrics suggest that improvements in training clearly improve customer service scores. A lot of businesses will tell you that, but he mentioned it improves their in-stock position in the individual stores. He mentioned during the earnings call, the more they pour into training and resources for their employees, the better their shelves look, the better they're able to keep everything in stock, and therefore the more they're able to sell. One of the reasons why their ticket size grew this last year as a function of those great same-store sales. Oh, and there's also this. 23% of Sprouts associates last year were promoted within the organization, and that's a higher rate than they've had in years past, in part due to the training initiatives. What they're doing with the associates is they're already receiving high-level training, so when they get promoted to managerial positions, they already know a little bit about what they're doing. You don't have the effect of what might be referred to as the Peter Principle, where people are employed and then promoted to the position where essentially they become the least competent. Rather, they're competent for that position and they already know they want to go to that position because they've received training about that position already. And their training initiatives being credited for some of that, but it also reduces onboarding costs for external management team openings as well. So it's a win-win-win there for Sprouts. And it's not just training for their staff. They also noted during the call, they plan on reallocating $10 million of their $18.7 million Tax Cuts and Jobs Act boost towards wages and benefits this next year. That's a much higher percentage than just about any retailer we've seen out there. And that's going to be good for retention, of course, which also reduces those long-term onboarding costs. But looking ahead, rather than reacting to the minimum wage hikes in certain areas, in certain cities, they mentioned they want to be proactive in raising wages in states that have scheduled wage hikes. They have a number of stores in Colorado and California, states that have wage hikes coming down the pike, and they feel like by being ahead of the curve, this is going to assist in recruiting and retention in those places. Retention, something that was mentioned at least a dozen times during the call, and that's honestly refreshing for a retailer, which oftentimes on an earnings call like this, you hear over and over talking about trimming costs on that end. And their retention has already improved dramatically in the last year as a result of their existing investments in wages within the company, and that's before this additional $10 million. Some of the other things that they're exciting about at Sprouts, the implementation of new systems on the back end. And this will allow them to go more just in time in terms of stocking of perishables. And they feel like it will help them reduce shrink to the point where they're going to see expanding margins in 2019. They don't feel like it'll expand margins necessarily even at the end of 2018. But by 2019, these systems will be in place across their chain, will expand margins, and will allow them to fork over more capital expenditures in 2019, which suggests to a long-term expansion plan. And remember the whole big Whole Foods Amazon Prime delivery that was rolled out this month? We've covered it on a podcast before. We questioned how that would affect Sprouts' existing partnership with Prime Delivery. Well, Meredia wouldn't comment on their Amazon partnership on the call. He was asked by one analyst about it, but he did mention that their growth going forward would be entirely through Instacart. And they said they're looking at delivery in all of Sprouts markets by the end of 2018 through this Instacart partnership. That is a massive goal. And what they talked about during the call was capturing this incrementality, basically luring customers that are outside of a 7 to 10 minute drive time to shop at Sprouts. Unlike other grocers, they don't have neighborhood locations necessarily. They have hub locations. So Meredia and company talked about being able to draw some of those people that live outside that 7 to 10 minute drive time window to shopping at Sprouts where they didn't shop at Sprouts before. And they felt like this was going to make sure that delivery wasn't a money loser for them like it might be for other retailers. that's something that's rarely talked about, is that delivery may not boost you on margins like you might think. And this program that they want to 100% of stores, this is massively ambitious, but it's made possible by their primary residents in large cities rather than some small to mid-sized markets. Most of the cities that they're in are at least over 100,000 people, ensuring that Instacart has a presence there. And that's something that a retailer like Kroger would have to overcome in order to reach 100% delivery capacity for them. And finally, they were excited about their private label initiatives as they continue to grow. Private label penetration in their stores has doubled. It's up to 12% since last year. A lot of things to be excited about, Leighton, and they've laid out some guidance for 2018 that suggests that they feel like more growth is right around the corner.
All of the initiatives that you just stated, literally all of them, have to do with customer retention and customer loyalty, because you're forming a brand here. While Sprouts is relatively new in the grocery space, you can see that all of the initiatives are tied to keeping people to keep coming in through their doors, or at least engaging with a Sprouts platform in some form or fashion. For 2018, the guidance is actually pretty good as a result of this and continued stores. They expect sales to taper slightly, with growth numbers around 11.5 to 12.5%. The growth is projected to be a function of adding those stores, around 30, to their store base, and also boosting same-store sales around 2.5% to 3.5%, just slightly above the numbers that we're hearing from food inflation for 2018 thus far. And speaking of that food inflation, Sprouts projects it to grow only slightly for 2018. Same-store sales, they said, are expected to see greater growth in the first half of this year due to easier comps from the first quarter and second quarter of 2017. Earnings per share of $1.22 to $1.28, a bump of around 25% from their adjusted earnings per share in 2017. An interesting note, capital expenditures of $165 to $170 million are expected, suggesting significant continued investment into the brand. They've already pitched in $186 million in capital expenditures in 2017, much of that ticketed to new store openings planned for 2018. So you see a lot of investment leading towards a grand future. We will definitely keep everyone posted on their numbers in 2018. We move on to our last story with Advance Auto Parts. Advance Auto Parts advanced through their earnings expectations as they have benefited from cold weather over the last few months. They reported for their fourth fiscal quarter for 2017, and the results came out on Wednesday of this week. For the quarter ending December 30th, we see that revenue, the company had 2.2% less of it. Total sales for the 12 weeks ended for the fourth quarter were not that great, but the company came in around $2.037 billion compared to around $2.08 billion, which is not too horrible. You look at same-store sales, they were down 2.6%, which is not that good, but they were up against a 3.1% comp from last year. They did have six less total stores year over year as well, 5,186 stores in all right now that they are operating throughout the United States. The company was also a little bit down in terms of gross margins, where gross profit was 42.9% of sales, around 70 basis points difference from 2016. They also spent a little bit more in terms of general and administrative costs, and adjusted SG&A was actually a little bit better off by around 24 basis points. You see a lot of statements here throughout the earnings presentation from CEO Thomas Greco. Greco pointed out rather quickly that they were up against tough comps from 2016 with those 3.1% same-store sales figures last quarter. But these tough comps, that's not necessarily the only reason they fell short. However, he did speak of continued transformation within the company, leading to the idea that the company is going to fare off way better in 2018, really trying to highlight the service differentiation that Advance Auto Parts brings to the table and their frontline team members. They're saying that the training is above and beyond their competitors, and because of that experience, when you come into an Advance Auto Parts, you are likely to keep on coming whenever you need an auto part or advice on how to install a certain component for your vehicle. Automotive categories we don't talk about often, Trent, on the podcast, but for Advance Auto, they did notice an acceleration in demand for some specific items.
Lighting and wiper blades included among those items. They also noted that the sales were offset a bit by the cooling categories, which again would be expected since it's not summer, and again, the weather was very cold. A lot of battery sales for the fourth quarter, which might have been helped out by that winter weather. And they also mentioned a recent Interstate Batteries partnership where they'll be carrying a large assortment in-store and online as well. Using the Interstate Batteries partnership as an example, their CEO, again, Thomas Greco, went on to say that they'll be looking towards creating and maintaining some strong brand relationships above and beyond Interstate Batteries in the future. And this is something that they're going to have to do because, again, when we talk about Advance Auto Parts, we don't talk about them often because O'Reilly and AutoZone are dominating this space. Again, we like initiatives from AutoZone with their distribution network that they're building out through stores, and Advance Auto Parts has a long way to go before meeting the performance of those two companies who have had pretty good same-store sales over the last few years. Between embracing these brands and also customer service, both over the phone, which you know still exists for auto parts stores, a lot of people, again, moving that online, but they said the phone is still a crucial key to what they offer, and customer service in store. They're hoping for longer-term growth between the next 2 and 5 years, and they mentioned adding products online so they can advertise a larger assortment, even if they're not carrying those directly in the stores. Building out their distribution network, again, not as robust as AutoZone, but at least they're making strides. And they're trying to push a membership model with what they call Advanced Pro for the professional customers, for which they have around 12,000 now in total. We talk about AutoZone leading in distribution. O'Reilly's really does lead in terms of that professional membership model. So again, headwinds there for Advanced Auto. Their guidance for full year 2018 was tepid, with the company predicting $9.1 to $9.4 billion in sales, which again, not a significant increase over this last year's sales. Same store sales, they're predicting between 0 and negative 2%. Not a good sign when your competitors are projecting same store sales in the positive. Their adjusted operating margin, they want between 7.3 and 7.8%. Now, shares of the stock were up because of the analyst beat to around $119 a share. That's around a 12% pop. Now they're back down to $110 per share. And overall, market cap of around $8.16 billion with a PE ratio of 24. To put it in perspective, their largest competitor in AutoZone, their market cap significantly higher, $19.6 billion. And they have a price to earnings ratio of just 16 as a result of their rather profitable quarters of late and the fact that their margin is a little bit more than Advance Auto's margin, which has been in decline since the company's same-store sales have been dipping.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus Podcast. Rach Layton and I look ahead towards one story we're keeping an eye on over the next week or month. And as is tradition, we keep it with Layton.
My looking ahead really has to do with something we would be talking about on the Old Food Focus podcast, mine with Dine Equity, the parent company of Applebee's and IHOP, a company we've talked about a little bit on this podcast. They're looking to close around 130 locations, actually between 120 and 160 per the reports that came out earlier this week, most of which are going to be Applebee's locations. They've already closed 99 Applebee's last year and 23 IHOP locations, and that percentage is actually likely to carry over into 2018. The company didn't specify what locations exactly they're going to be closing, but we can assume that they are probably going to be in some struggling markets. And what's interesting, Trent, here, and this is why it's my looking ahead, is the company was extremely vocal, perhaps for the first time, about wanting to spend a lot of money on buying new chains. They're actually looking to spend some money on acquisition for chains with 100 or less locations in the coming year or two, specifically $100 million towards the end of 2018 and beginning of 2019 for these new acquisitions. Obviously, they didn't name names, but perhaps they're going to be privately held entities with an up-and-coming fast casual type segment. So you're looking at a company here that's a little bit older, struggling a lot in terms of Applebee's, and really IHOP is doing okay, but you see those comps struggling too relative to the rest of that industry. And you're looking at the stock price, Trent. Shareholders applauded this. Over the last 5 days or so, the stock is up around $13 a share after this news came out. It was around $55 a share, which was a relative low for the company, now trading around $69. And so you see a company that does have to transform, and they've really taken a liking to the fast casual concept. I am curious to see if they take a concept in, perhaps at the end of this year, and take those same practices, those best practices, and employ those at IHOP and Applebee's for the future. A lot of goings on with this company, but again, this is a massive company. I am curious to see if it can transform and keep on going with its mission. But again, if you look at its five-year graph trend, they are down significantly from all-time highs of around $110 a share.
Well, I'm looking toward the dollar store category, and a new CEO signed on board this week at 99 cents only stores. It's Jack Sinclair. He's currently 99 cents only stores head merchant and marketer. He becomes their CEO, succeeding Jeffrey Covert, who's retiring after a 44-year career in retail. Now, Sinclair's background, I think this is what I'm looking ahead to. He spent the last several years before coming to 99 cent stores at Walmart. And in fact, he led the grocery sector of Walmart US for 8 years from 2007 to 2015. Now, we've seen 99 cent stores make more of a foray into food over the last few years, particularly since Sinclair came over. And you wonder if this appointment as CEO signals more of a trend that they're moving into food in their current markets. Now, they have 391 stores in California, Texas, Nevada, and Arizona. And again, trying to expand just slightly in those particular markets. But you wonder if they can start to make some hay in a dollar store segment that has traditionally not looked at fresh goods as an option. They have by far and away more fresh goods than any of the current dollar store operators in the U.S. of the same size or larger. They've got a long way to go to match the thousands of stores that, say, a Dollar Tree or a Family Dollar or a Dollar General might have. But at the same time, they have what those chains don't, an increased focus on grocery and an increased focus on fresh items. And they have a CEO now running the company who is very in tune and very in touch with those things and very attuned with what they need to do on the grocery front to make sure their margins increase over the next several years, because that's where the 99 cent store has been struggling of late, is on the margin front. Well, that'll do it for us on the Retail Focus podcast. Again, big thanks to the folks from Brother, both Michael and Jeff, for joining us, talking about how retail and printing come together and about some of the things that Brother is doing to try and adjust to the printing needs of a new era of retail. For Layton, I'm Trent. Make sure and rate us wherever you listen to us, and we'll see you 1 week from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.